Okay, Alexander, let's talk about the aftermath. Actually, kind of what's going on now, but more than that, the aftermath when we do get through the entire world and each individual country gets through the corona crisis. And I think one of the big fears that a lot of people have, and I feel it too, now that Cyprus entered a lockdown. Which I still don't understand why they've decided to lock down the country as aggressively as they did, because they had everything under control and they're just doing harm to their economy. Very bizarre, but the lockdown, you can feel that it takes away your freedoms and your civil liberties. And I think that one thing that I've noticed, and I know all our viewers know as well, is that when you have times of massive crisis and world-changing events, something like 9/11 comes to mind in this case. You look toward to the government to come and lead you through these types of crises, but the government seems to impose restrictions upon your civil liberties. Maybe they're needed at that time in order to restore order or to get things, to an acceptable state. But the government always seems to keep many of those restrictions in place. Going back to 9/11, you had a lot of your freedoms taken away as far as surveillance and the Patriot Act and a lot of the legislation that the Bush administration put into place. And it never really got rolled back when things got back to normal. And so I really have a sense that when all is said and done with the corona crisis, many countries around the world and many governments that are imposing very harsh and very strict restrictions on people's movements and freedoms, I think a lot of these restrictions might last and might be there for the long term. What do you make of that?
I think this is a very, very valid fear, a very legitimate fear. Now, can I make one thing absolutely clear? I'm one of these people who takes the corona crisis extremely seriously. I'm getting reports now from people within the National Health Service here in England. I spoke to someone today, and I'm hearing very grim tales coming out. I mean, things are very, very difficult for health service workers. They are inundated with cases. There's a genuine worry that they don't have enough facilities or resources to absorb every case if this thing were to be allowed to run unchecked. And in that sort of situation, it wouldn't just be people who catch this disease, this infection, who they would struggle to treat. It will be all sorts of other people also. And I'm well familiar with the arguments that this is a minor illness, which has only a 1% mortality rate. But I would repeat again, that 1% mortality rate is achieved because people up to now have been receiving treatment. If they didn't receive treatment, what I'm being told is that it would spike very quickly. And of course, if health systems break down, not only would that happen, but all sorts of other people who might have all kinds of other unrelated illnesses for which they might be able to get treatment, they would also be in peril too. I just wanted to make that point because this is, I think, something I want to make clear. I take this crisis seriously, very seriously. But the price of liberty, as many people have said, is perpetual vigilance. Unfortunately, what we have seen, partly because our governments, all our governments, certainly the government in Britain, did not take this problem as seriously as they should have done at the start when it first began to loom over the horizon, so that they didn't prepare the health systems adequately. They didn't bring in enough, put in enough ventilators, for example, which are crucial for treating a disease like this. They didn't have enough beds. They didn't do all of these things. They're now using that as an argument that the health services need to be protected, and so they need to place all these draconian restrictions on people's everyday lives. Now, I will say again, I don't think this was done with that intention in mind. I don't go along with some of these theories that this is a phony crisis concocted in order to bring in all of these restrictions. Why would they destroy their own economies, which is what's happening, in order to do that? But the trouble with restrictions like this is that they become sticky. When governments impose restrictions on movements, when they start levying fines, when they start disregarding liberties, fundamental liberties, are in a kind of routine way, is that they start to like their ability to do that, because it gives them more social control. And the very great worry we must all have will be that when this crisis is overcome, which it will be very difficult to prize some of this away from the governments that are giving themselves these powers. Now, I'm going to say something else, though, and I think this is the counterpoint. Firstly, there are a lot of lawyers and people like this, people who care about liberties, who are already pushing back very hard. And that's a very good thing. And I think that will also happen. I also think an awful lot of people will not accept having their liberties, their lives restricted in this way indefinitely, unless they feel that there is a good reason for this. And I think if the disease abates and governments go on imposing these restrictions, then we will have a pushback with a vengeance, a popular pushback with a vengeance. But these are not groundless fears. They're completely legitimate fears. We should take them extremely seriously. And I've already read articles, especially by American lawyers, where constitutional rights and freedoms are taken seriously, or at least seriously by some people, who are already pointing out that there are all sorts of provisions in the Constitution which are coming under increasing challenge.
Yeah, but the U.S., I think, is an interesting case in that they have a lot of their civil liberties built into their Constitution, you know, the freedom of speech being the most prominent and well-known, and that's protected. Many countries don't have that freedom of speech protected or written into their constitution. And then I think you have the most interesting X factor in all of this to me, which is technology and the smartphone. Yeah. And there are already a lot of governments that are using the smartphone and various apps in order to track people who have either come in contact with someone who has corona or has corona. And so they're tracking them using the smartphone and keeping tabs on them. And I understand that it makes sense. Okay, I want to keep tabs on this person and their location, where they're going and who they're having contact with, or the people that have had contact with this person, to see how this is spreading. But as we say, when this is all said and done and we get over this crisis, which we will, is that tracking going to stay? Is that surveillance going to stay? Most probably it could. It could stay. I mean, we saw it in Russiagate. We saw the surveillance state in action to throw an election in favor of Hillary Clinton and against Donald Trump. So it's not out of the realm of possibility to see the surveillance state, the FBIs, the CIAs, and every country's intelligence agencies abusing their power. And now they may have legislation because of the virus to do such things.
Well, indeed, sir. I mean, the point to make here is, of course, the National Security Agency, as we know from Edward Snowden's revelations, carries out massive surveillance on a gigantic scale. It already tracks people. The CIA, as we know from the Vault 7 revelations that WikiLeaks did, already is able to read an awful lot of emails and mobile phone messages, and it can also do all sorts of extraordinary things there to sort of create impressions that all sorts of people are doing things which they're not doing. So the trend was already, before this health crisis emerged, very, very much in that direction. And the worry has to be that this particular crisis is going to give it a further impulse, and that we're going to move even further. Now, I've been to China, and you know, China is a country with which I have great respect for in many respects. I'm you know, nobody can be blind to China's achievements, but I saw the degree of social control that the Chinese authorities have over everyday life in China, and the way they use technology to keep track on people, and they do to a quite astonishing degree. And I hope we do not end up there in the West. I think that would be extremely unhappy and bad for everybody. But, you know, come back to what I said, the price of freedom is perpetual vigilance. People need to be more organized about this than they were. And I think the first point that they should be asking about when this crisis starts to abate is, how did it happen at all? Why were health systems left in such a disorganized state up to now? Why were governments so unprepared? And is the real solution to avoiding problems like this in future increasing surveillance? Surely we should be addressing the question of our health systems instead. That's just one example.
Yeah, well, the crisis spiraled out of control, in my opinion, because of the ideology and the dogma of open
borders.
And it's interesting to see that that dogma of open borders, which helped the virus spread so rapidly and so quickly, is now going to lead to more surveillance. You know, open the borders, but we'll surveil you, you know,
absolutely,
all the more.
Well, this is exactly the way. I mean, consistency. Yeah. We need. There is a complete lack of philosophical coherence any longer. So, you know, I read an article in which he said that now Germany has restrictions on movements. They've imposed them themselves. Finally, restrictions on movements within the European Union. So, you know, they've opted out of the free movement provision. Finally. Except, of course, that refugees could still enter Germany at this time. So if you are someone from France or Belgium or the Netherlands or, you know, EU country or Hungary or Poland or wherever, you can't enter Germany. But if you are, or say you are, a refugee coming from Afghanistan, apparently you can.
Doesn't make any sense. That's from Summit News. Yeah, Paul Joseph Watson, Summit News. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense at all.
That doesn't make any sense at a time like this. I mean, you know, that seems completely illogical to me. And, you know, I think that people need to think through, firstly, the kind of societies they want to live in and how those should function. And obviously they need to have governments, and those governments need to function. But they also need to be accountable governments under proper democratic control. And you're absolutely right to say that in the United States, protections are embedded in constitution. That's not always the case everywhere else, and it's not always the case in Europe. And the tradition in Europe is not there. There is the European Convention for Human Rights, but the European Court of Human Rights is not a constitutional court. Its decisions are non-binding.
You know, it reminds me of the fact that all these the governments, the oligarchs, the George Soros, the Bill Gates, the kleptocrats in the EU, you know, they're not going to let a crisis go to waste, as the saying goes. And even though this thing may have surprised them or caught them off guard or, you know, spiraled out of control, they're not going to let this crisis go to waste, and they are going to capitalize on what's going on in order to amass more power. I think that's
indeed.
And it's going to come at the expense of our liberties and our freedoms.
Well, if we let them, I mean, you know, it does to some extent fall on us too. But I agree. I mean, you know, all these people do want to increase control. And we at the Duran have been very much the victim of this, as so many other independent media have been. So they try to restrict what we say. And that, you know, that could easily expand into trying to restrict how people move and what they do. So we've got to be careful about it.
Finally, Alexander, the final question is balancing, you know, the security and the safety with the economics of the country. I think a lot of countries are going to have a challenge, and they're already undergoing the challenge as to how much is too much restriction and clamping down on liberties and lockdown.
Yeah.
In comparison with when should we start opening up our economy? You know, I think everyone's trying to find that balance. Trump gave an interesting press conference in the daily briefings that he's giving now, where he hinted that in a couple of weeks, you know, he's going to start opening up the economy because it just can't be shut down for this much longer. And he's seeing the mortality rates and the figures, and they're seeing that, okay, maybe the risk of opening up the economy is outweighs the actual figures that they're getting. So, you know, we should open it up a little bit and let the economy start to move. And so what do you make of that, each country that's going to have to undergo this challenge?
Well, it's going to be
massive. When is enough enough, and when do we have to start getting the economic engines rolling again?
Well, I mean, that's going to be a major challenge and a very difficult one. I think that Trump is getting a little bit ahead of himself. I think at the moment he's still got to, the US still has to get on top of the situation with this disease in the United States. I don't think it's there. But eventually, life has to return to normal. There has to be back a return to proper economic life. It's difficult to know how that's going to happen. But look, it's in a sense, the parameters are clear. You bring the internal epidemic under control. You reduce it to a small number of cases, and then you're able to observe those cases. And when you detect them, you're able to find out who are the other people who might have been infected by those individuals, and you can treat them and control them and control the spread of the disease. By the way, the policy that you had in Cyprus, which put restrictions on borders very quickly, and seemed to contain the epidemic in Cyprus very successfully. And I'm baffled, by the way, why Cyprus, which seemed to have the situation under control, is suddenly moving to a lockdown, which the numbers in Cyprus don't seem to me to justify. That's an aside. But that's what you need. That's the situation you need to get to, where, as I said, people know, people have an idea who is infected. It's relatively small numbers. You can control them. You've got hospital facilities that are not going to be overwhelmed, and you can control it that way. And then you can move forward to restarting your economies and working towards getting a normal life back into gear. Now, I think that the United States is some way from that position. I'm being polite now. And I think Donald Trump is ahead of himself. I think he has his own concerns, because obviously he wants to be back toward in a functioning economy well before the November 2020 election. But also, and I think this is a fact, I think he is generally concerned about the enormous damage that has been done to the economic fabric of the United States whilst this situation continues. But I think we are still some way. I mean, he was talking about Easter. I doubt it will be Easter before he's able to actually start reducing those restrictions. That's my own personal view. In Britain, by the way, it's a much more chaotic situation. And I think we are going to be looking at this dragging on perhaps into May and even June.
Yeah, it seems to me that the formula for success in this, in beating this at this moment in time, was you had to shut your external borders right away.
Which none of the Western
states. The countries that did it first, for example, Cyprus, Russia is another example. And they're not going to let people in until May 1st in Russia as well. No foreigners are coming in. So you shut your borders right away. You get a grip as to who in your country inside your borders has a disease and who they've come in contact with.
Yes.
You also shut down, you lock down various establishments where people gather.
Yeah.
So as to stop the spreading. And once you've got that under control, then you can start to treat the people. Obviously, you can start to open up the domestic market piece by piece. Once again, I don't think you want to open up your country to the external market, to the globalist worldview, for lack of a better word. That's going to probably take some time. But domestically, you can start to think about how to get the domestic market involved once again, restaurants, the cafes, and all these things moving again. So once you've locked down your country, you've identified the people that have it, who they've come in contact with, and your health system is stabilized.
You can't open up your country until the disease is under control everywhere. I mean, I don't say completely eliminated, but under control everywhere. Because otherwise, if you open up your country, then you will simply get your population reinfected from outside. That is why you need to have control of your borders. Now, China, by imposing very tough restrictions, was able to basically get control of the disease within China but it still hasn't opened up its borders, but its economy is now starting to revive. Russia started to put controls on its borders in the middle of January, long before anybody else did. I remember, to everybody's astonishment, they stopped travel from China on the 21st of January, the day after the Chinese confirmed that the disease could spread from human to human. The Russians put restrictions. They basically stopped travel from China. So they've been able, as a result, to hold the total number of infections down to around 470.
But as far as economics goes, Alexander, for each country, just the final point is, and you mentioned it about China, which is very much an export-oriented economy. Their challenge now is how do they get their domestic market ramping up? Because I think that's going to be every country's challenge is as those borders are closed and you can't open up, every country's going to have to figure out a way, how do you get the domestic market to at least cover the costs of what's happened? You know, how do you get that domestic market, you know, revving up?
Two things to say about this. Firstly, globalization is now impossible. The kind of globalization we had before can't happen because we can't have a globalized world because, as I said, if we do, people are simply going to get reinfected. We can't have a situation like that until we have a proper vaccine and treatment program in place for a disease for which at the moment we have neither a vaccine nor an affordable treatment program based on drugs. We can't put everybody, we can't put hundreds of thousands of people on ventilators. Not only is that logistically incredibly difficult, ventilators are very tough forms of treatment. I should know, my father died under one. So, you know, we can't operate that basis. So, we can't have that kind of absolutely free movement of people and of goods that we had before this disease began to take hold at the start of this year. So, globalization is over. If you're going to look at building up markets, that is going to be prove incredibly challenging. Some economies have certain inherent advantages. Now, the two big continental self-sufficient economies are China and the United are Russia and the United States, in that they are actually self-sufficient in most products. I mean, if you actually look at the US, it doesn't actually trade that much because it produces nearly all of what it consumes, and what it doesn't have to trade. Because it can produce most of its food, most of its energy, most of its durable goods. By the way, Russia is the same. I mean, Russia is a country which is pretty self-sufficient, and it already is. I mean, because the Russians have always tended to go in for autarky, and since 2014, the sanctions war, they've gone even further down that road. So they can tick along, you know, reasonably well without much trade either. China is in a different position because it is not that kind of economy. It needs to import raw materials, it needs to import energy, it needs to import food. And it's going to be a challenge to do that. And I think the way you do that is you find partners you can work with, and you have to have a certain degree of regulated and planned trade because you can't just have the kind of completely free market in trade that we've had up to now, because free markets in trade go with free movements in trade.
Yeah. And tourist-oriented markets
and
are going to have
period,
a very hard time.
very, very hard time. But, you know, it can be done. These are not impossible things, but they do need strong governments, strong states, and regulation in markets of a kind that we've not had before. I would stress this is not going to be an indefinite thing. I mean, eventually we will have a vaccine, we will have treatments that can control this particular disease. We will get there. We're not actually that far from that. But for a period, we are looking at these challenges, and not every country has the knowledge of this, but it will have to be organized at national state level. And coming back to the first part of our program here, and I wanted, you know, I'm going to say this again. If we're going to protect our liberties, we need to hold our governments to our account. How do we hold our governments to account? We do them through democratic institutions, through our democracies, and that can only happen in any practical way at within sovereign states.
Right.
I mean, that's the only way to do it, ultimately. One of the reasons why one is more worried in some ways about these restrictions in Europe, in the European Union, is because, of course, governments here are weak. So that gives security forces potentially more power to do things like that, because there aren't those, either those democratic checks that you can exert through elections, and there are not the legal and constitutional checks either, because constitutions mean less and less in Europe anyway, because they've been diluted through the European system. And as I said, the European Convention for Human Rights is administered by the European Court for Human Rights, whose judgments anyway are not mandatory. They're only advisory. And many people feel anyway unhappy about the whole way in which the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, and the convention works. So we have a complicated situation. But you said, I mean, I come back. We have to do it. We have to fight to protect our liberties. The only way we can do that practically is within our own countries. And that has to be done through democracy in our countries. And that means sovereignty for our countries. That is the reality of it.
Yeah, well said. Alexander McCurse, Editor-in-Chief of The Durant. Thank you very much. Guys, if you like this video, click on the subscribe button down below. Click on the notifications bell and smash that like button. Also, look for us on iTunes and SoundCloud for an audio copy of this video. And please donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, and Subscribestar. Your donation helps keep this channel up and running. And please visit the Durant shop and pick up some merchandise, magic mugs, and polo t-shirts like the one Alexander is wearing today.
Absolutely. I mean, can I just say, I mean, we should not give up on things, and we should certainly not give up on our magnificent Durant magic mugs, despite these hard times, because these magic mugs are what sustain Alex and me through the long hours of the night and the day as we have to research these stories. And, you know, sometimes they can be pretty difficult reading, but we're able to do it because we have our Durant mugs with our infinite cups of, well, tea in my case, coffee in Alex's case. But, you know, they keep us going. And you cannot drink tea or coffee in a more elegant and satisfying way than from a Durant mug. They are the best mugs in the business. And I should know, I've had scores and hundreds and probably thousands of mugs in my time. They're beautiful. They're beautifully made. They're all porcelain and really fine and good porcelain. By the way, porcelain comes in many different grades and varieties and forms. You can have pretty, you know, brittle and bad porcelain. This is a magnificent porcelain. It's the sort of porcelain that an emperor of China might have had. It is of that quality. So it is a magnificent porcelain with this beautiful glaze. This mug, of course, has the emblem of the Alpha Force, the mug that Alex has, or I saw him drinking from it. It's got that of the Russian Federation, or at least I understand of the Russian government. I'm going to say more about that because a Russian viewer, by the way, corrected me on certain points about Russian heraldic devices. But I will come back to that shortly. But that is the double-headed eagle that, on Alex's mug, that you will find on Vladimir Putin's mugs. But our mugs, I maintain and insist, are better. And we don't just have our amazing magic mugs, strong, beautiful, light, and perfect as they are, but you also have, as Alex rightly said, our amazing Durant polo shirts that I'm wearing at the moment, 100% cotton, beautifully made, with a double-headed eagle of the Durant, which is different from the Russian double-headed eagle, immensely strong and hard-wearing, extraordinarily comfortable, and you can wear them in the most amazing and elegant places. So, amazing Durand polo shirts, but we've also got lots of other types of shirts, all of the same quality. When we set up the shop, Alex took a decision. We discussed it. Alex took a decision to go for quality as a sign of our respect for our viewers. And you can find 100% cotton, beautifully made Durand t-shirts, long sleeved and short sleeved. And you can find V-neck shirts, and you can find hats, hoodies, and stickers of the same quality. And you can also find our ebooks, which we discuss subjects like Russiagate and Ukrainegate and Brexit and Epstein, all in our shop. You support us by buying these things from our shop. Alex has pointed out many times how much pressure we come under at the Durand, but you can support us by coming to our shop. You can own these great things by doing so. So don't hold back. Come to our shop. Buy these great things. Alex will tell you how.
Just go to thedurandshop.com. You'll find a link in the description box down below. Alexander McCurse, thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.